OKEEFE from Biloxi. BILOXI.
Yeah.
March 27th, 1974.
But you are now 25 and serving your first term in the House.
I'm 27.
27
right
now.
This is my third year in the House.
Third year in the House, okay.
It's my first term.
I keep forgetting it's 4-year term instead of 2 years.
Right.
Right. And your father was in the House before you, is that
right,
correct?
60 to 64.
Are you a lawyer?
No, I was in law school at the time I was elected, and I was at Tulane Law School in New Orleans, and after I was successful in the election, it was necessary to move back to Mississippi. I kind of frown on people living in Louisiana representing Mississippi.
Did you finish school?
No, I just quit. I'll be working with my father now. My father's a mayor of Biloxi, by the way. He just got elected last summer.
Let me ask you one question about Biloxi. I'm just a little looking at some election returns. And the Gulf, the urban areas on the Gulf are one of the few urban areas that Senator Eastland ran very strong in, you know, well above his statewide percentage.
Well, I think that Eastland's strong in the money circles, you know. And the money's concentrated in urban areas, you know. I think he, and that's where his influence comes. You know, he helps people on the coast a great deal in business. And, so that's what I'd attribute the main thing to it.
But then in that congressional race down there, the Democratic nominee carried that county against Trent Lott also.
Well, the Democratic nominee was from that county.
Is that the explanation?
He was from Harrison County, and as far as carrying the county, he did rather poorly at that. You know, it was less than 60%. You know. Trent Lott did pretty well on the coast and outside of Jackson County, which was a little surprising. You know. We weren't satisfied with the campaign that Ben Stone made at all. Thought he did it, handle it rather poorly. But I don't know that he could have won with Nixon took a great personal interest in Lott's race.
Would that reflect Lott's better showing down there than Carmichael's?
I'm sure that's true, yeah. You know, Julie Nixon came down and made a speech for him, and you know, Nixon really got involved in it. He made some statements about it and was on television with him, and this, they had pictures of the two together. And it's, how you doing?
Taking care of
him? Yeah.
Okay.
If he had done the same thing for Carmichael, could it have made a difference statewide?
Who?
If Nixon had taken that same interest in Carmichael's race. We've heard two theories. One is that if Nixon had really backed Carmichael actually might have won that race. The other is it really wouldn't have made any difference.
Well, I think it would have had some influence. I think the fact that the attitude that Nixon took towards the race led a lot of people to believe that maybe, you know, even some Republican people felt that, maybe they would be better off with Eastland, who is philosophically a Republican anyway.
How was this term in the legislature different than you thought it would be?
Well, this particular term is no different than
how about your service?
Well, I was just amazed, you know, at the difference between what you read in books about political history and state government and all that, and the way it actually works and the way you read about it, you know, such a great difference.
What were these differences? I mean, what did you expect and what did you find? You said you quickly learned how things operated. How do they operate in Mississippi? That's what we're sort of really trying to understand.
Well, I'm sure they operate probably the same everywhere, you know, as far as I've been able to tell. When you read about how a bill becomes law, you know, you read that it's introduced, and then it's referred to a committee, and then the committee can appoint a subcommittee to study it, and they study it and make a recommendation to the committee, which in turn makes a recommendation, and then it's debated fully, you know, in the committee and on the House floor, and that's just not true. Bills, you see bills go flying through the legislature with an interest group special interest group pushing a particular piece of legislation. The debate is very limited. There's no real consideration of the merits of the bill whatsoever. It's just jammed through, you know, and it's kind of frustrating when you see things like that happen.
What are the interest groups that really have that sort of influence that if, you know, this interest group wants a bill through, it's going to be almost automatic in some states? You know, in South Carolina, for example, I don't think they have a bill that doesn't get through to the bankers.
Well, the bankers are definitely probably the most strong outside interest in state government, and they have been for several years. I mean, and there's no bill, really, that the bankers need to push through because they already got them all through. They have everything they could possibly want. Outside of them, I'd probably rate the Department of Agriculture as second. And then the junior colleges are right in there. You know, they're within the government itself, but nevertheless, they operate pretty strong.
Do they have their own lobbyist?
No, they just they take people on the state payroll and station them here in the capital, you know. And that's how they operate. You know, I don't like it. I was the chairman of a subcommittee this year to studying ethics. We had several bills on ethics and conflicts of interest and lobbying and all that. And there was a lot of public support for it, but unfortunately there wasn't a whole lot in the legislature. So we're going to have an interim study committee this coming year on it. But the whole field just needs to be looked at in this state. You know. At the outset of this year, I made a public statement attacking the interest groups such as insurance, power companies, banks, retail merchants, manufacturers. All of these people have unregistered lobbyists, you know, and I named who they were. And previous to this year, the law we have has been on the books since 1914. The most lobbyists we've had registered in any one year is 14. Right now, as of about a week ago, over 50 had registered this year as a result of that. But oddly enough, none of the ones that I had named have registered. You know, the most effective ones we've had, the women's groups and all the, you know, Common Cause, AFL-CIO, these people have registered. But none of the ones that I named have registered.
Their lobbyists don't even register at all?
No.
What happened when you named the names?
Caused quite a furor, you know. It was really controversial in the legislature, you know, because these guys are nice guys, you know, and they make a lot of friends over the years. And people who are, you know, really in the power structure, who are liberal thinking and progressive, you know, even they got timid, you know, when it came to picking on somebody like that. You know.
I did a book on lobbyists in Michigan. When I was a delegate at the Constitutional Convention, I read the provisions about lobbyists and conflict of interest in legislation. And I had more enemies at the introduction, just the first one on lobbyists, that never quite recovered from that. Once they got used to the idea of being regulated, in the sense that they could register and just report what they spent, they didn't object to it. But that first step was extremely difficult.
Well, we have a real strong law as far as lobbying and registration
what
is concerned.
What was your interest in this regard, and how did you arrive at that?
Well, I was just named the chairman of a subcommittee, you know, so I took it from there.
What do you see as the major political problems in meeting with, well, let me ask you this, what do you think are the major issues facing Mississippi in terms of political issues, genuine issues?
Well, we had one issue this year that I was really concerned with. We passed Consumer Protection Bill. I was the author of it. I've been trying to pass it for 3 years now. It passed both houses. I think that was something that was really badly needed in this state. You know, over 40 states have these kind of laws, you know, similar to the FTC law. And as far as personal interest, that was my number one statewide personal interest. other issues facing us. There's no telling what kind of spin-offs this energy crisis thing's going to have, you know. We haven't this year experienced any concrete problem that we could deal with at the local level other than some allocation of extra gas supplies that come through the governor's office and things like that. I think probably the greatest need in the state today is what needs to be looked at the most is our tax structure. Our taxes, we have very low corporate tax. Corporations are taxed at the same rate as individuals in the state. I think our severance tax on timber and oil needs to be looked at. I think the state income tax needs to be looked at, the sales tax. You know, Mississippi was the first state in the country to institute a sales tax. Did you know that?
I hadn't seen that.
You know why?
Yeah, I know why.
Is there any difference on the concern about issues between the younger members of the legislature like yourself and some of the older ones? Do you notice any distinct differences on issues of style?
Concerns? One of them really came apparent, you know. A lot of the people in the power structure now in the House, I'm just speaking for the House, not the Senate, are fairly young, under 50, you know, and have accrued to these positions of leadership through hard work, and they're really progressive. I mean, I think the House has good direction in it right now.
Progressive in what sense? In the old populist sense?
No, I think they're progressive in terms of the race issue, which is, it isn't reflected throughout the membership of the House, but the power structure itself. The people who comprise what I call the power structure in the House are progressive in that area, and they're progressive in, I think, most reforms outside of two. One is the conflict of interest type thing, and the other is the open meetings proposition. We saw virtually nobody in the power structure, you know, quote, vote for these open meeting propositions that we had in the House, even though, I mean, it's hard to argue against it, really. You can't sensibly argue to me that you should have closed committee meetings. You know, I can't think of any valid arguments for it except, you know, in certain cases where a person's integrity might be reflected upon or somebody's up for an appointment to a position or something like that. And I was surprised at the attitude that these members took in regard to both of those issues.
How about ethics legislation?
Well, I meant one of the issues I was talking about was ethics.
Okay.
When you say power structure, you refer to the presiding officer and the committee chairman or something
right.
else?
Right.
Is
you
there?
Say that they are atypical of the rest of the House?
Right. Yes.
And more progressive.
Yes. See, we've in this state, the legislature is a lot stronger than the governor to start with. The Speaker of the House has an inherent grip on what's going to happen in this state because he comes back year after year. That's different than the lieutenant governor running the Senate. And he has just virtual all the power he wants. All he needs to do is exercise it, be strong enough to exercise it, as Walter Sillis did when he was the Speaker. He was the Speaker for, I think, 40 years or something. And they name, first of all the committee chairmen, they name. There are no elected committee chairmen whatsoever. He names the vice chairman. He names who goes on what committee. And then he refers every bill to every committee. And I mean, the power to be able to do that alone, you could control anything you want.
And am I correct that the bills are just arbitrarily assigned to whichever committee? It doesn't really matter too much what the bill is. What is in
it? No, well, I would say generally that the bill will go to a committee that, you know.
But the options are.
Well, some other options are I mean, you have bills that deal with two fields, you know, like, for instance, we had the milk bill to establish a milk commission up this year. The Speaker could have, had he wanted, he sent it to the Agriculture Committee, but he could have sent it to also to Ways and Means because it was going to raise revenue by taxing processes and
things. Or it would have gone to appropriations because it needed one.
Right. But, and sometimes you'll see the Speaker use that, but normally, just because of the Speaker's enormous influence, it isn't necessary for him to have to use the power in that way. You know, it's kind of one way when you don't even have an opportunity, you know. But the Speaker, what he would probably do, he would send the bill to the committee, but then he would let it be known in no uncertain terms that this, he doesn't want this bill to come out of the committee, you know. Of course, the committee chairman, all being his lieutenants, they name all their subcommittees. And if they want a particular bill to die, well, they just find three guys who are opposed to the bill and say, now you're the subcommittee. How about studying this for a couple of years?
You know, how can the House leadership be younger and more progressive than the total body?
Well, I think that
when seniority determines who's going to end up, or doesn't it determine that?
Seniority isn't followed in the House, not strictly. I mean, there are people with a lot of seniority that don't even have a committee chairmanship.
And the Speaker elected by the House membership.
Right. I think that the more capable members of the House are the ones who have ended up with the key committee chairmanships. Just because, I mean, if you're going to be the Speaker, you're going to have to try, it's going to be your responsibility to try to have an orderly legislative process. You got to have people who know what the hell they're doing when they come down on the floor with a piece of legislation, you know. And the best thinkers and the more hard-working people are the ones who have ended up with the chairmanships. For instance, the fellow who's chairman of Ways and acting chairman of Ways and Means right now has only been in the legislature 14 years. There's probably 20 people been in here longer than him. Chairman of Appropriations hadn't been here. I think he's been here a while. But all throughout, the chairman of Banks and Banking, John Stennis, 10 years. You know, it's Insurance, Teddy Millett, he's been here 10 years. All of the positions like that are falling to people who work, plus there's an attitude of a lot of the older members that they just don't want the heat, you know, they want to be here and have a good time, get to vote on everything, be a part of it, but they just can't stand the pressure or something. Don't want the responsibility or either incapable of handling it.
So there's another difference, and other than just the one based on race, so the basic difference was one's stand on race, whether it's progressive or not.
No, well, so, I'd say that's an attitude. That if you take a person in Mississippi, and if he's fairly liberal on the race issue, well, you're going to find that he's not going to be a hell of a conservative in all these other areas too, you know.
You mean there aren't a lot of people who are very conservative on race, and when you remove that issue, that they're not populist then?
I don't know what you mean by populist.
Well, an orientation towards the people, more progressive, a greater role for state government, more spending, more progressive taxation, that sort of thing.
Well, I would just say that, you know, their attitude in general, they're open-minded, they, you know, willing to modify their position after listening to arguments pro and con. And they aren't die-hard type people, you know, that just have a fixed belief and they're going to go carry it to the grave, you know. I mean, they change with the times, you know. That isn't true of everybody.
But you're saying that negativism or opposition on the race issue extends to other issues as well. And that's the basic distinction.
Right. It does. Has anybody mentioned to you that we passed a resolution in the House about a month ago memorializing Congress to repeal the Voting Rights Act?
You did?
Yeah. Had four no votes. Me and three other blacks. The one black in the House voted against it, and Walter Brown from Natchez, and Gerald Blessing and myself from Biloxi voted against it. That's how scared they are of it, and that does not reflect the true attitude of the people sitting over there. But when it came to them pressing a button for or against it, they had a vote immediately before that on to recommit it back to the Rules Committee. And I think it had 36 votes just trying to recommit it.
Those representatives perceive that back in their districts, the people are still that uptight about this.
Right.
Is that a correct perception?
That's one.
Did you catch a lot of hell when you did it?
I guess I was contacted maybe 10 times about the vote. And every one of them was favorable. They were really happy. And they weren't all black either.
What has been the impact of the Voting Rights Act in Mississippi?
Well, I don't think it's had much impact. I think as far as actually changing the legislature, changing the elected officials, which is the great potential it had. Today we see only one black in the entire legislature in the House. I mean, you can judge from that alone, you know. The fact that they have more people registered now. But I can't understand why the blacks don't exercise their power. You know, they have it. There's something like, there's close to 40 counties, close to half of the counties in the state with a black majority of population and voters. Why don't they send blacks up here? Beats the hell out of me.
Well, does it affect the type of whites that are sent up here?
I think it affects them to some degree. I think it takes some that I know of some that are really just hardcore segregationists. But they come from a district where, well, there's one, but there's several like that that actually come from these counties with black majorities. But they're very quiet, you know, and there's some that, you know, pretty vocal, but these particular ones, even though they really feel strong, they're mighty, mighty quiet about it.
So the only effect it really had is made them was cut down on the rhetoric.
Yeah.
But they, even so, when you have a test on the rhetoric, and you push the old button again, you got five guys or four guys who had enough. Now, suppose that there was not a resolution. Suppose it was a bill that would have done something.
I don't know. Scares me.
What you're saying is the perception of your colleagues is that it's still that hot out there.
Either that or they just, you know, just a tradition, you know. It's really ridiculous, you know. I got a kick out of one particular legislator who's in the power structure. He's a really progressive guy, you know. And he couldn't bring himself to vote against it, so he just left the chamber. You know, he didn't vote for it. He took a walk, you know.
Mr. Speaker, had I been in my right mind, I would not have voted.
That's the only particular one I saw take a walk. But, and that's the only,
still,
and that's the only
what
issue,
would happen?
That's
what
the only
would happen?
Issue I've ever seen him dodge. The only one.
I ask you, what would happen if someone introduced a resolution in the Mississippi House to designate Martin Luther King Day in Mississippi on his birthday, not as a state holiday, but as a designated day? What would you think the vote would be?
Boy, it'd be a bad vote.
Would it be similar to this
be
vote?
Be mighty red up on the board.
Would it be similar to this vote on the Voting Rights Act? The reason I asked that is in South Carolina that passed this year.
No.
No, but my question is when blacks run, do they normally run for the legislature as a third-party candidate or in the Democratic primary?
No, they usually run as Democrats.
And they frequently make the
Everybody
runoff
runs
and then...
as Democrats in this state, just about. We have two Republicans in the House. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Well, let me get back to this kind of mindset of the legislators. What are the things going to happen? Something going to happen to them back in the district? It's not going to be raised as an issue in any future campaign. Is it an open, blatant issue anymore?
Well, I hope that there'll be some severe repercussions from that vote. I mean...
No, but what I'm trying to get at, it seems to me in some ways the people may be a little bit better in the legislature.
How?
Well...
Was much more liberal than I'd say any other section of the state. The Delta area, believe it or not, is probably second outside of the race issue as far as taxation and things like that.
But is the fear a real one in terms of the repercussion? Do these guys really fear this, or is it just kind of a...
I'll tell you what the fear was, the real fear, the reaction I felt when the thing was on the floor was that the people on the floor were mad at the Rules Committee for making them have to vote on it, because it was a clear-cut issue. They were going to alienate one segment or another by their vote. And no politician likes to cast that kind of vote to start with, you know. It's a lot easier to try to amend something, do this or do that, you know. And a lot of issues, you know, parallel, but not really right at the heart, the way that was.
That's it. I mean, that you couldn't get a more straightforward vote.
That's right. And they were mad because they had to actually be put on the spot of having to make that decision. Of course, not all of them. I mean, a lot of them really voted their convictions when they voted aye. You know?
No, but for a large group, a number of them, though, they did apparently what they thought ought to be done. That was... So how are things any different, I say, on voting on an issue like that now than they were 6 or 7 years ago?
Well, I'll give you a parallel. Following that vote, we had another bill that came out of a Apportionment and Elections Committee, which is chaired by Stone Barefield, who wrote the resolution to repeal the Voting Rights Act. And he's forever coming out with different little bills affecting the way you cast your ballots, you know, and stuff like this, which, like, they passed one last year, 2 years ago, which said that it isn't necessary to put your ballot in this little, kind of a little folder, you know. And what it does, it just, to me, it meant that the guy has his ballot and he has to just go stick it in the box, you know. Just the fear of having somebody see what his vote is, you know, might make him vote otherwise, you know, just because it isn't really as secret as it could be. And then, well, following this vote on the resolution, we had another bill that would have allowed the election commissioner at the time of the vote, when the people came to vote, to require that they produce birth certificate, driver's license, or other evidence as to their identity. Not that they could produce any one of these things, but they could require, you know, anything that they wanted. And I made a motion to recommit that to the committee, but when the House sent it back like that.
Well, there's a difference now that the House just prefers to avoid dealing with racial issues. We want to get it out, whereas 6, 7, 8 years ago, they almost looked forward to
actively.
I mean, this was the sort of thing they enjoyed letting off steam, boy, by voting against any kind of, or voting for any sort of
resolution. I'd say that's a good assessment.
They were delighted to do it 6 or 7 years ago, but they're pissed off to do it this time. But they're not resolved. look at it just in terms of the record, it's the same.
Right.
If you read it out there, right?
Right, if you read the record. But I think in the area of race relations...
But there's more, there's more of a, much more of a tendency just to submerge the race issue and keep it out of the...
that's why that's irritating when it's brought up again, I would guess.
All right. For instance, this last governor's race was the first race in which the two final contenders, neither one of them had race as an issue, period. Neither one of them spoke anti-black issue in their campaign.
Did either of them
first time?
Did either of them use code words at all?
No.